Here on Radio 4 FM, we continue our Book of the Week. Hull West MP, the Right Honourable Alan Johnson, has written a second volume of memoirs, Please, Mr. Postman, chronicling the career that took him to high office as a senior government minister. As a decade ends, Alan starts to be politicised.
On the 5th of July 1969, the Rolling Stones gave a free concert in Hyde Park, and I left Notting Hill for the last time. We'd probably have gone to the concert ourselves if we hadn't had something more important to do. While the Flower Children were listening to Mick Jagger's recitation of Shelley in homage to Brian Jones, who died a couple of days earlier, we were loading our possessions into a small removals van to be driven 30 miles west to the Britwell Estate in Slough. We had received a letter from the London County Council telling us that our house was being compulsorily purchased to be demolished. As Judy and I had been on the housing list for less than a year, we would be given one offer. The letter from the LCC was addressed to Judy. Householders had to be over 21, the so-called age of majority. I had just turned 19, Judy was now 23, so the council house would need to be in her name. We had no hesitation in accepting the one lifeline we'd been given by the council. We would make the Britwell Estate our home. As the 1960s drew to a close, Judy and I were settled in our new surroundings. She had quickly immersed herself in the community, helping to set up a playgroup for toddlers. I'd joined Slough Library, where I graduated from reading up on modern history to books on political theory interspersed with the novels I preferred. Christmas 1969 was, in effect, our first together, as Judy had been in hospital the previous year, giving birth to Emma. I remained as fresh-faced at 19 as I'd been at 9, so when Judy bought me my first razor for Christmas, there was no real use for it. Nonetheless, I rushed into the bathroom to shave with it on Christmas morning. When I came downstairs rubbing my chin in a manly kind of way and professing to have had a great shave, Judy inquired whether I'd managed to get the blade in all right. I told her there had already been a blade in the razor. She informed me, rather tartly, that it was a dummy made of cardboard for display purposes only. It had felt fine to me. The Labour government that had been in power since 1964 had steered through a good deal of groundbreaking legislation that reflected the dramatic social shifts of the 1960s. Laws had been enacted to protect ethnic minorities from racial discrimination. Homosexuality had been decriminalised. Capital punishment abolished. Abortion legalised. Women were beginning to assert their right to equal treatment. Even the post office had been revolutionised. The Post Office Act of 1969 changed it from a government department to a statutory corporation. As part of the transformation, telecommunications were split from postal services. It was one of the biggest shake-ups of the post office since its inception. I remember being very much aware of its historical significance when I returned to the sorting office at the end of my last shift as a civil servant. As my old bandmate Sham had cautioned when encouraging me to become a postman, the only way to earn a decent wage was either to get a second job or to take advantage of the abundance of overtime generated by the perennial shortage of staff. So I worked the docket, the Davy Crockett. That fountain of extra earnings nourished my children, but it also deprived me of seeing as much of their childhood as I wanted to. I remember once asking a postman who was leaving how long he'd worked at Slough Sorting Office. His answer was 5 years. 9 if you counted the overtime. Among the crew was Pat Paternoster, the unofficial foreman and one of the hardest workers I'd ever seen. Pat was lean and fit, a man in perpetual motion, gulping down his tea in a couple of minutes and constantly on the lookout for tasks to keep him busy, even if it was just tidying the skips or sweeping the floor. Pat wasn't a conversationalist, but over the years I worked with him, I discovered his motivation. He was determined that his children would go to university, and every spare copper he made was channeled into that ambition. It wasn't a unique aspiration, but it was rare among working-class men born in an era when only a tiny elite went into higher education. It was as if every parcel Pat sorted, every bag he hefted onto the back of a van, every load he dragged across the parcel office floor would bring him closer to his goal. I've never seen a smile as broad as Pat's when he told me some years later that his eldest daughter had been accepted at Cambridge. What I can't remember is any defining moment when I became politically aware. Can anyone? Is there ever an epiphany, a single event that separates the pre-political from the post-political? For most of us, it's a gradual development directed to begin with by our perceptions and experiences of our own worlds. I'd lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis without knowing much about it as mankind teetered on the brink of nuclear war. And like everyone else, I saw the world as being divided between capitalism and communism. I found myself in one half and was keen to understand the other. Thus my political consciousness evolved from the books I borrowed from Slough Library and society as I experienced it on the Britwell Estate and at Slough Sorting Office. As we entered the new decade, the seeds were being sown for two very different events that would mark it indelibly for me. As Judy and I were deciding that we'd like another child, pressure was building that would explode in another far more serious post office strike. I knew there was trouble brewing between my employer and my union. In late 1970, when we were asked by the Union of Post Office Workers to down tools in a token stoppage supporting the chairman of the post office, who'd just been sacked. Lord Hall was the first chairman of the newly created public corporation, which was supposed to have been removed from government control. I knew nothing about Lord Hall then, and little more now. His dismissal was seen as an attempt by a newly elected Conservative government to remove a chairman considered too sympathetic to the workforce. So we went to the canteen for a couple of hours on what must have been one of the few occasions when a union took industrial action in support of a corporation's boss. The Labour government that had been in office for the best part of 6 years had been ousted by the Conservatives barely 6 months into the new decade. Labour won Slough, but lost the country. With the Tories in office, led by Edward Heath, one aspect of the swirl of events propelling us towards industrial conflict was the determination of the incoming government to tame the trade union movement through a national industrial relations court. The industrial action of 1971 was the first all-out post office strike involving all grades across the country in the union's history. There was a deep-seated grievance about pay. Now that we were no longer civil servants, it was felt that we had to assert ourselves in the new commercial environment we had been forced to enter. Every week a union rally would be held in Hyde Park. These were huge affairs. At that time there was another dispute going on involving college lecturers who were pursuing some esoteric issue concerning their contracts. Sometimes our long column of marching post office workers crossed their much smaller demonstration. Whereas we had a clear objective, what do we want? 3 quid! Theirs was more opaque. Their banners read, "Rectify the anomaly." Very much an academic dispute. I could not have been described as an activist in the great 1971 strike. I did my bit, religiously attending the meetings every Tuesday, occasionally going to a rally, a smattering of picket duty. I can't pretend either that I used the time I had on my hands to toil over domestic chores in the house that was now home to 2 adults and 3 small children. Judy was coping with a newborn baby and 2 toddlers with minimal help from me. We had no car, no fridge, no washing machine, no vacuum cleaner, and no phone either. Judy washed the clothes by hand exactly as my mother had done, scrubbing the collars of my shirts against a washboard, squeezing as much water as possible out of each garment by brute force before hanging it on a clothes horse to dry in front of the fire. Our living conditions were a universe away from the slums where I'd spent my childhood, but the memory of the tallyman and my mother's debts still haunted me. We were both terrified of debt. The order of the purchases we planned to make was agreed in advance, each to be saved for consecutively. A twin tub washing machine was the priority. We were about to board the coaches bound for another Hyde Park rally when news reached us that the strike was to be called off. It had lasted for 47 days. It was seen as a crushing defeat. It would be a long time before the membership had the stomach for another national strike. My sporting skills were on show every Sunday morning playing local league football for Slough Postal FC. When the match finished at around noon, I'd go straight to the British Legion where the play was always the same. Act one was the greeting phase, where we'd pool our resources in a whip round, decide who was to hold the whip, get the first drink in and buy our bingo tickets ready for Act 2. My tipple was a pint of mild, a drink that tastes exactly as it sounds, and I would savour those first refreshing mouthfuls after my exertions on the football pitch. Act 1 was the only opportunity we had for conversation, so we'd chew over the week's events while helping ourselves to the cubes of cheddar cheese and silver skin onions provided free in bowls dotted around the hall. Act 2 was the bingo. Bingo was a solemn pursuit. The whole of that large British Legion Hall, where there would be 150 drinkers on a Sunday lunchtime, would sit like druid monks in eerie silence as the caller pronounced the sacred words, "Eyes down looking." The prize money was £10 for the first person to get a line and £20 for a full house. On the rare occasion any of us had a full house, the custom was for the lucky winner to buy a round, which came to under a quid. Act 3 was the card school. We'd play crib for half an hour or so. After that, the serious stuff. Usually 7-card brag, occasionally poker. We played for small stakes, 5p and 10p pieces. It was rare to hear the rustle of notes from any of the card schools around us, just about visible through the thickening fog of cigarette smoke. There was always music, usually from a trio of piano, drums and double bass, belting out the old songs that my father used to play in the pubs of Notting Hill, mingled with more recent favourites popularised by Engelbert Humperdinck, Tom Jones or Ken Dodd. Act 4 was exiting the stage. At 2:30pm, closing time, I would buy a bottle of light ale to take back for Judy, which she'd drink while putting the final touches to the roast dinner. If I was working, I'd gobble down my dinner before setting off for the sorting office. If I wasn't working, there was the big match to watch on ITV, followed by a snooze in the armchair with the Sunday papers across my lap. I'm conscious that this creates a fair impression of Andy Capp, of a bloke with a self-centred social life that left his wife to look after the kids, cook, wash, and make a comfortable home. And that was pretty much the division of labour back then. I worked as many hours as I could to bring home the bacon, and Judy ran everything else. My boozing may have been confined to Friday evenings and Sunday lunchtimes, and my gambling to Sunday bingo and cards, but I was nonetheless perpetuating the male lifestyle adopted by my father, if not the excesses to which he took it. After the strike, I began to broaden my consumption of poetry. Later in 1971, the bicentenary of the death of Thomas Gray was commemorated at the St Giles Parish Churchyard in Stoke Poges, where he was said to have composed his famous elegy written in a country churchyard. Stoke Poges was only 5 minutes away from our council house, so Judy and I went there with the kids. I bought a leather bookmark embossed with 4 verses from the elegy in gold lettering. My appetite whetted, I looked up the entire poem in Slough Library, becoming increasingly intrigued by its theme of greatness denied by accident of birth. I'd soon learned my favourite lines by heart. Full many a gem of purest ray serene, the dark unfathomed caves of ocean bear. Full many a flower is born to blush unseen and waste its sweetness on the desert air. I saw those flowers all around me in Slough.
Please, Mr. Postman was written and read by Alan Johnson. It's a heavy entertainment production for BBC Radio 4. After the news, Nicole Fari on why she's moved from fashion to sculpture in Woman's Hour.
On Thursday, will Scotland vote for independence or to stay part of the United Kingdom? The BBC's online coverage will keep you up to date with every development.
We've brought together the biggest names in Scottish politics to debate the country's future.
Plus, in-depth analysis, expert opinion and live streaming of the key moments.
It will be the people that make the choice, and it's a choice about what is Scottish society going to become.
The Scottish referendum across the BBC. On TV, radio and online. For more information, search online for BBC Scotland Decides.